Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin DNR. Preventing food waste and composting scraps and uneaten veggies, grains, and fruit can help the environment. More dnr.wi.gov by searching food waste.
Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Elizabeth Bishop was one of the great poets of the 20th century. She didn't write a lot, but everything she did write had a kind of perfection to it, even though her subjects were anything but poetic. She wrote about ordinary things, like fishing and sitting in a dentist's waiting room. Most of Elizabeth Bishop's work was published in the New Yorker magazine, and now, thanks to writer Joelle Beal, we can get a first-hand glimpse of how Bishop and her editors collaborated. Beal recently edited a book called Elizabeth Bishop and the New Yorker, The Complete Correspondence. She told Anne Strangechamps what happened to Bishop's poems when they were submitted to the New Yorker.
The poem would come in, let's say, to Catherine White, and she would read it and decide whether she wanted the poem or not. Whether she said yes or no, she had to bring it to another editor to get a vote, which would usually be Howard Moss, but it could be someone else who was on hand, like William Maxwell. And then they would vote on it. If they were both a no, the poem would go immediately back to Elizabeth Bishop. But if they were a no and a yes, or a yes and a yes, the poem would either go to editor-in-chief Harold Ross when he was there, or later to William Shawn. And Shawn and Ross had final say. So if they said no, that was it, even if White and Moss were a yes.
Boy, this is a complicated system of checks and balances. Sounds like the American government.
And they were very guarded in how they would let Bishop know about the votes. They loved to use the royal we, and I asked an old-time editor there, I said, why did you use we? And they said, we never wanted, you know, anyone to be mad at any one of us individually. We just said the votes were a no, and they didn't want to reveal who voted how.
You never got to know who the Russian judge was.
So things were often phrased in the passive voice when you got your things back. So, for instance, with the shampoo, Catherine White says, the votes were mixed, but the nose had it in the end.
Well, how did Bishop respond when her work was rejected? That must have been hard for her.
It was. I think the shampoo was a particularly difficult rejection for her.
The shampoo?
This poem, The Shampoo, which was about washing Lotus Juarez's hair. The reason why it was probably rejected is because it was an openly lesbian love poem. And The New Yorker did not publish anything that had to do with homosexuality. And I think Bishop took the rejection quite personally, since she knew all of the editors and they knew of her sexuality. And they had been writing back and forth about Bishop's time in Brazil and her relationship with Lota. They'd known of her other relationships. And I think she took the rejection then quite personally because they accepted her, or they seemed to accept her, as friends. But when it came to publishing something, they wouldn't do it.
Hmm. Now, I'm curious about the editing part of poems, because I guess until I read some of these letters, it hadn't really occurred to me that that much work would go into editing a poem. But one of the recurring topics of correspondence between Bishop and her editors at The New Yorker is punctuation.
Yeah. I think the source for that goes back to Harold Ross, who founded the magazine and had previously been a newspaper editor and whose mother had been a grade school teacher. I think he took the lessons she taught him into the newspaper business, and he applied those rules to the magazine and to poetry, to the captions and cartoons. Everything, punctuation-wise, had to be perfect. So even as far as poems had to be cleared for libel, poems had to be fact-checked just as if they were a newspaper story.
How do you fact-check a poem?
If there is any reference to a historical figure, if a mythological figure comes up, they were checked. to see if they actually existed. There was a poem once by Theodore Ruthke, and he made up a biblical figure called the Mother of Har. And they questioned the Mother of Har. And Ruthke's response was, well, if the Mother of Har didn't exist, she should have.
Oh, she does now.
So they were checked. In the poem In the Waiting Room, there was discussion about the fictitious date. The photos Bishop is referring to do not occur in the February 1918 issue. So that was checked and discussed.
And when it got to the punctuation, what sort of punctuation issues came up?
Well, the style guide for The New Yorker was Fowler's Modern English Usage. And so they just lived and died by Fowler's. And with Bishop, they were especially strict, one of the editors had told me, since she had a reputation for being a very exacting poet. And they were very concerned that anything unusual on her part, anything out of the ordinary, might look like a mistake on either her part or theirs. And so they were very sure to follow things with Fowler for her poetry, whereas with some other poets, let's say W.S. Merwin, who had no punctuation, he was allowed to do that because that was his thing. Or in the 70s, there were some other poets who were more playful with punctuation, but that was their reputation. How much The New Yorker gave Bishop that reputation, it could be a whole other subject, because she was sending in poems that played with punctuation from the very beginning.
How important is punctuation in poetry?
Well, it has to do, I think, with pacing and, for Bishop, turns of thought, tonal varieties. Bishop's poetry often wants to enact a mind thinking, and so the commas will indicate pauses, maybe the mind going back on itself, rethinking something, revising it and going forward. And The New Yorker did not, for Bishop in particular, like to see punctuation to be used for effects, as in music, a short pause or a longer pause, let's say. They didn't believe in that, and they wanted to use it kind of by the book.
So something as simple as the placement of a comma could really change the way you read a line of poetry?
It can. It can. In Bishop, it can.
Do you have a favorite letter or exchange of letters about punctuation?
Yes, I do. This is about At the Fish Houses, which Bishop sent to Catherine White in February 1945. When she sent it in, she called it an unusable poem, and they were delighted with it and wanted to buy it right away. When the proof was made up, Catherine White wrote Elizabeth Bishop, and the date for this letter is February 25th, 1947. And she says, "Dear Miss Bishop, our proof room, which has a highly conventional idea of punctuation, had scores of punctuation queries on the Fish Houses poem. But we have eliminated the major portion of them, since your lack of punctuation is purposeful and adds to your effect. Will you please study the few commas now suggested and see whether you approve? I only left in the ones I thought would really help the reader, but you may not agree. In this case, it should be as you want it. Sincerely, Catherine S. White." February 28, 1947. "Dear Mrs. White, I think the proof looks very nice, and thank you for your help with the punctuation. I have left in all your changes except the commas between cold, dark, deep that occurs twice. For some reason or other, it seems more liquid to me without them, and I think in this case, the sense is plain enough without them, don't you? I noticed that quite a few tails of P's and Y's, etc., are missing, but I imagine that is just because it's proof. Sincerely yours, Elizabeth Bishop."
What happened in the case of those commas? Did they stay in or stay out?
There was no more correspondence about the commas, and so they ended up staying in. What I love about this exchange is how Bishop sets up her defense, which she begins it very softly with, "for some reason or other," and then she moves on to describe it as liquid, which I think gives a real sense of the effects she wanted to create. And then she embroidered the rest of the sentence with a rhetorical question with, "I think in this case, the sense is plain enough without them, don't you?" And White ended up agreeing.
cold, dark, deep, and absolutely clear, the clear, gray, icy water. Back behind us, the dignified tall firs begin, bluish, associating with their shadows. A million Christmas trees stand waiting for Christmas. The water seems suspended above the rounded gray and blue-gray stones. I've seen it over and over, the same sea, the same, slightly, indifferently swinging above the stones, icily free above the stones, and then the world. If you should dip your hand in, your wrist would ache immediately. Your bones would begin to ache, and your hand would burn as if the water were a transmutation of fire that feeds on stones and burns with a dark gray flame. If you tasted it, it would first taste bitter, then briny, then surely burn your tongue. It is like what we imagine knowledge to be, dark, salt, clear, moving, utterly free. Drawn from the cold, hard mouth of the world, derived from the rocky breasts forever, flowing and drawn. And since our knowledge is historical, flowing and flown.
That's a recording of Elizabeth Bishop reading the end of her poem At the Fish Houses in 1974. Bishop died in 1979. Joelle Beal is the editor of Elizabeth Bishop and the New Yorker, The Complete Correspondence. Beal spoke with Anne Strainchamps.